Today we're going to discuss the matter of Judah and Assyria. Last time we saw how the kingdom of Israel in the north was brought to a close under Assyrian rule, where the majority of the people were exiled and national life and independence was totally eliminated. We turn our attention now to chapter 16 of 2 Kings, which sits as sort of an insert between chapter 15 and 17. 2 Kings 15 and 17, and taken together, detail the final collapse of Israel, the northern kingdom. Chapter 16 is an insert chapter describing some events that occurred to the nation of Judah during the last days of the northern kingdom of Israel. We can begin reading in chapter 16 in verse 1. In the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the king of Judah, began to reign. 20 years old was Ahaz when he began to reign, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem, and did not that which was right in the sight of the Eternal his God, like David his father. Now, that's a fairly standard passage. That passage could be applied to many kings in the history of Judah, especially this point about not doing that which was right in the sight of the Eternal. However, in the case of Ahaz, God inspired his word to be somewhat expanded. And we read in verse 3 and 4 that he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, yea, and made his son to pass through the fire, according to the abominations of the heathen whom the Eternal had cast out before the children of Israel. And he sacrificed and burnt incense in the high places, and on the hills, and under every green tree. We have a fuller treatment of Ahaz's sins, spiritually speaking, in terms of false worship. Now, there's a reason why we are given this additional information. It is necessary background for understanding his great mistake that he made during his reign. God inspired the word to record this so we would understand that Ahaz was a man who did not know at all what it meant to put faith in God. That his heart was totally removed from God, and therefore there was no way, when the crisis of his reign came, that he could put the proper kind of faith in God. Now, the crisis is introduced in verse 5. Rezin, the king of Aram, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to war. They besieged Ahaz, but could not overcome him. They couldn't overcome him in Jerusalem, but it mentions almost parenthetically in verse 6 that at the time Rezin, the king of Aram, recovered Eilat to Aram and drove the Jews from Eilat. Now, Eilat, of course, was the southern seaport on the Red Sea. And the Arameans, of course, are always struggling with the Israelite kingdoms for advantage in terms of these trade routes. And so it's not surprising that they took it. Now, what is it that caused this particular alliance, however, between Rezin, the king of Aram, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel? Why is it they both gang up on Ahaz of Judah? Well, if we turn to Isaiah chapter 7, we can understand it. Isaiah chapter 7 will begin in verse 1. It came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the day son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, the king of Judah, that Rezin, the king of Aram, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, went up toward Jerusalem to war against it, but could not prevail it. And it was told the house of David, saying, Aram is confederate, or allied, with Ephraim. And his heart, meaning the heart of the king of Judah, was moved, and the heart of his people, as the trees of the wood are moved with the wind, sort of like the wind we've been experiencing the past 2 days. In other words, they were terribly shaken. Their courage was totally removed from them. Their knees were shaking and knocking together because of this alliance against them. Now, what is the reason for this alliance? The reason is given in verse 5 and verse 6. Aram and Ephraim, the son of Remaliah, have taken evil counsel against you, saying, meaning against Ahaz, let us go up against Judah and vex it, and let us make a breach therein for us, and set a king in the midst of it, even the son of Tabeel. Very clear. Aram and Ephraim desire to replace Ahaz with a king of their own liking, who is called the son of Tabeel. Of course, God could not allow that to happen, no matter how sinful Ahaz was, because he had promised, of course, that David's line would continue until, of course, the whole nation was taken away, that it would continue on the throne. Now, why is it that Aram and Israel want to do away with Ahaz and put somebody else on the throne? Well, as I mentioned last time, in the days of Pekah, Pekah rebelled against Assyria. He rebelled against Assyria along with the king of Damascus, whose name was Rezin. And they were trying to organize a grand coalition to fight against the Assyrians. They knew that by themselves, they couldn't successfully resist the Assyrians. But they felt that they could organize a grand coalition of Phoenician cities and Philistine cities and Israel and Judah and Edom and Aram, that they could possibly push the Assyrians back across the Euphrates River. And they were remembering that they had enjoyed success when they organized such a coalition in the days of King Ahab. So this was the reasoning behind their attack on Judah. It is obvious from what is said, what is not said is obvious from what is said. It nowhere tells us in the Bible they directly approached Ahaz to join the coalition, and Ahaz said no. But it's rather obvious from their actions that are mentioned in the scripture when you put it together with secular records that that must have been the case. But they asked him to join this coalition, and he said no. Now they are coming with military force against him, and his knees are shaking, and the knees of all of his people are shaking. And so we go back in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 3, and we see that the Eternal said to Isaiah, go forth to meet Ahaz, you and Sherashiasha, your son, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool and the highway of the fuller's field. And this is the message that God commissioned Isaiah to give to Ahaz. Say to him, take heed and be quiet. Don't be afraid. Neither be faint-hearted because of these two tales of these smoldering firebrands, as it should be rendered. Of these smoldering firebrands. For the fierce anger of Rezin with Syria, or Aram rather, and of the son of Remaliah. In other words, God inspires Isaiah to say to Ahaz, you're afraid of Rezin of Aram, you're afraid of Remaliah of Israel, but they are merely smoldering firebrands. Don't be afraid of them. Now, why does God inspire Isaiah to call them smoldering firebrands? What is a smoldering firebrand or a smoldering torch? Yes, it's on its way out. It's just about ready to be extinguished. When it's smoldering, it's still smoking, but there's no real flame anymore. In other words, God is saying, hey, you think these are mighty powerful nations that are about to stomp all over you? Well, they may look like that, but they're really not. their flame has really gone out. They're merely on their last legs, tottering before they're pushed over. So don't be afraid of them. Trust me. But you see, this is the one thing Ahaz had not been able to do, because his whole life prevented him from trusting God. So God was patient with Ahaz for David's sake. And so we find in verse 10, the Eternal spoke again to Ahaz, saying, obviously through Isaiah, ask a sign of the Eternal your God. Ask it either in the depth or in the height above. Look how generous God was. He could have just said, through Isaiah, such and such is going to happen, and that will be a sign. Well, then Ahaz might have said, well, maybe it was coincidence, you know, or maybe Isaiah stage managed it. So God is giving him a chance to set the sign himself out of his own head. So there's no way it could be a coincidence or stage managed by Isaiah. He is trying to give him every reason to have faith. And what does Ahaz say? He says, I will not ask, neither will I tempt the Eternal. Now, this is not a modest, humble, spiritual attitude. It's a man who's too afraid even to ask for a sign, because he has no faith at all. But God was determined to give him a sign. And so he said through Isaiah, after warning him that it's enough to weary men, but he's in the process of wearying God with his actions and his words, he says, however, the Eternal himself shall give you a sign. Now, what is the sign to Ahaz? Isn't that the meaning of the verse? The Eternal will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Many do not realize that that was meant for Ahaz. That was a sign for that age. They only see it as a messianic prophecy fulfilled in Christ. That was its secondary meaning. Through inspiration of God, in the days of Jesus' parents, it was perceived that this prophecy of long ago was to have another meaning. But the prophecy as it was given by Isaiah was meant to be fulfilled right then. It's the only possible meaning. Otherwise, how in the world could that have proved to be a sign to Ahaz to strengthen his faith? Wouldn't have gone very far to strengthen his faith to tell him, centuries from now, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and his mother and father shall call his name Emmanuel. Well, great. I mean, how is that supposed to strengthen his faith? And he tells them in verse 16 that before the child shall know to refuse evil and choose good, the land that you abhor shall be forsaken of both her kings, that these enemies of yours shall have been destroyed, even before this child is old enough to know to choose the good and refuse the evil. In other words, just be patient, have faith, do nothing, trust me for a few years, and you will see that you will be safe. But Ahaz could not wait. And so, if we go back, save your place here in Isaiah, but let's go back to 2 Kings 16. Second Kings 16, verse 7. Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria, saying, I am your vassal. by saying I am your son, he's in saying you are my father, it's a, I enter into a vassal relationship with you. Come up and save me out of the hand of the king of Aram and out of the hand of the king of Israel, which are rising up against me. And Achaz took the silver and gold that was found in the house of the Eternal and in the treasures of the king's house and sent it as a tribute payment to the king of Assyria. Because he lacked faith, Achaz surrendered the independence of his country on a silver platter to Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria, in an effort to induce Tiglath-Pileser to come down militarily against Rezin of Damascus and against Pekah of Israel. What foolishness. What foolishness. Because there was no question that Tiglath-Pileser would have attacked his two enemies anyway. But a man that has no faith sometimes can't even reason straight. And apparently this was the case with Achaz. He couldn't even reason straight, and so he delivered his country on a silver platter to Tiglath-Pileser. He willingly became a vassal. We come down to verse 9, and we read, the king of Assyria hearkened to him. The king of Assyria went up against Damascus and took it, and carried the people of it captive to Kir, slew Rezin. This was the end of national existence in this period for Aram. They had already been in the stage 2 vassal relationship. Now they were in stage 3. They had their extinction as a nation, and they were carried massively deported from their homeland. Now, we read, of course, in chapter 15, or rather 17, that, right, I guess it was 15, that he also carried away many people from Israel as he reduced Israel into a staged or type 2 Assyrian vassal state. But King Achaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria, and he saw an altar that was at Damascus. And King Achaz sent to Uriah, the priest, the fashion of the altar, the pattern of it, according to all the workmanship thereof. And Uriah the priest built an altar according to all that King Achaz had sent him from Damascus. So Uriah the priest made it in advance of King Achaz's return from Damascus. And when the king was come from Damascus, the king saw the altar, the new one, and the king approached the altar and offered thereon. He burnt his burnt offering and meat offering and poured his drink offering and sprinkled the blood of the peace offerings upon the altar. And he brought also the brazen altar, which was before the Eternal, from the forecourt of the house, from between the altar and the house of the Eternal, and put it on the north side of the altar. In other words, he rearranged things, giving the preeminence to this new altar, the pattern of which he had seen in Damascus and he had arranged to have built before he returned. And at this new altar, he officiated as high priest, putting the altar of God in a secondary position, letting that be serviced, of course, by the regular high priest. Now, why in the world did Achaz do this? Did he go to the bright lights of Damascus and say, wow, what a fantastic altar, I've got to have one just like it? No, that wasn't it at all. The Assyrians imposed requirements on their vassal states. Not only obedience to general Assyrian policy, not only an annual tribute payment, but they insisted that each of their subject states worship one of their chief gods, at least, if not the whole Assyrian pantheon, as a symbol of their loyalty. Now, one of the chief gods of Assyria, as I've already said, was Ninurta, the god of storms and lightning, pictured by the eagle. Now, it was very easy for ancient peoples to make associations among different gods based on what responsibilities a particular god had. For example, when Alexander the Great went to Egypt, he had no difficulty in associating the traditional Greek god Apollo with the Egyptian god Amon, because they were both gods of the sun. That in the area of Phoenicia, they had little difficulty when the Greek influence came into the area of associating their ancient god Baal with the Greek god Zeus, since they fulfilled the same role. Now, Ninurta was the god of storms and lightning and rain, so that made him equivalent to the god Hadad of Damascus, who had the same responsibilities, and also made him equivalent to Baal in the Canaanite pantheon, because he had the same responsibilities. But the Assyrians decreed that all of their subjects in the western part of their empire were to worship Ninurta by worshiping according to the forms of the god Hadad. They picked the god Hadad specifically to be worshipped by their western subjects. Now, the Canaanites had no problem because they could see Baal and Hadad as similar, so they worshipped Hadad and understood in their minds and hearts they were simply worshipping Baal under another name. That's why when Ahaz was in Damascus, he sends back the fashion of the altar that he sees there, because Hadad is the god of Damascus. He needs an altar similar to the one in Damascus for Hadad to be worshipped in Jerusalem. And since this is a foreign cult, it is not the national cult of Yahweh, he officiates as high priest. As the king, he officiates at this altar to Hadad in the courts of the temple as high priest, offering the various offerings on it. Now, of course, this was a terrible sin, but he was made, you might say, forced into it, having made the beginning mistake of handing his country over to the Assyrians. Now, what happens when Ahaz dies? Well, even before he died, God warned through Isaiah that because of his foolishness, Judah was going to pay a terrible price. Let's go back to Isaiah chapter 8. Beginning in verse 5. The Eternal spoke also to me again, saying, "Forasmuch as this people refused the waters of Shiloah, that go softly, that refuse the aid and comfort and support and defense of God, and chose to do it their own way. And now they rejoice over the fall of Rezin and Remaliah, thinking, oh, we were right. We made a good decision here. We saved our skins. We got the king of Assyria to come down here and save us, and now we can rejoice over our enemies who have been destroyed by the Assyrians. Now, therefore, behold, the Lord brings up upon them the waters of the river, strong and many, even the king of Assyria in all his glory." This is not talking about Tiglath-Pileser, because Tiglath-Pileser was already there. It's talking about the future. "He shall come up over all of his channels and go over all of his banks." The king of Assyria is pictured as a river in flood stage overflowing its banks. "He shall pass through Judah. He shall overflow and go over. He shall reach even to the neck. And the stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel." In rather poetic speech through Isaiah, God is saying, a future king of Assyria is going to invade the land of Judah. He will fill the land. He will overflow until he reaches the neck. The whole nation shall be captured except that which is above the neck, which poetically speaking, is what? Jerusalem, the capital. God was prophesying in advance of the invasion of the Assyrian king Sennacherib, that he would come and conquer the entire nation except for the city of Jerusalem. And this was because of Ahaz's foolishness, which of course came out of his inability to have faith in God's protection. Now, Ahaz, late in his reign, associated his son Hezekiah on the throne. But Hezekiah, as the junior member of the governing team, had very little say in government policy. However, we go back now and we look at the death of Ahaz, we find that Hezekiah becomes sole ruler. And in 2 Chronicles, chapter 29, once Hezekiah is left alone, where he has freedom to act as he chooses, he reveals what is truly in his heart. 2 Chronicles, chapter 29. Hezekiah began to reign when he was 5 and 20 years old. He reigned 9 and 20 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abiah, the daughter of Zechariah. And he did that which was right in the sight of the Eternal, according to all that David his father had done. In the first year of his reign, in the first month, this means after his father was dead and he was left to rule on his own, the year being 715 or 714, he opened the doors of the house of the Eternal and repaired them. He brought in the priests and the Levites and gathered them together to the east street and commanded them, saying, "Hear me, you Levites, sanctify yourselves and sanctify the house of the Eternal God of your fathers and carry forth the filthiness out of the holy place. For our fathers have trespassed and done that which was evil in the eyes of the Eternal our God, and have forsaken him and have turned away their faces from the habitation of the Eternal and turned their backs. And they have shut up the doors of the porch and put out the lamps and have not burned incense nor offered burnt offerings in the holy place to the God of Israel." In other words, under the last years of Ahaz, the entire worship of God had just come to a complete stop. "Whereupon the wrath of the Eternal was upon Judah and Jerusalem, and he has delivered them to trouble, astonishment, and to hissing, as you see with your own eyes." Now, he sets himself to reestablish the proper worship of God. But he goes further. Notice he goes further. He actually invites the remnant of the northern kingdom, the Israelites, who are still left in the land to the north, living in the midst of all these paganized peoples who were brought in by the Assyrians. He invites them to join him and Judah in a rededication to the God they both claim to worship. Chapter 30. The year is either 715 or 714, depending on whether we count inclusively or exclusively, about 6 years after the fall of Samaria, the final fall of Samaria. Notice 2 Chronicles chapter 30. Hezekiah sent to all Israel and Judah. He wrote letters to Ephraim and Manasseh that they should come to the house of the Eternal at Jerusalem to keep the Passover to the Eternal, the God of Israel. Verse 5. They establish a decree to make proclamation throughout all Israel, from Beersheba even to Dan, that they should come to keep the Passover unto the Eternal, the God of Israel, at Jerusalem. For they had not done it for a long time in this way, as it was written. So the posts went with the letters from the king and his princes throughout all Israel and Judah, according to the commandment of the king, saying, "You children of Israel, He's talking now about the north. Turn again to the Eternal, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, and he will return to the remnant of you that are escaped out of the hand of the kings of Assyria. He's talking to that remnant left in the north. Don't be like your fathers and like your brethren, which trespassed against the Eternal God of their fathers, who therefore gave them up to desolation, as you see. Don't be stiff-necked as your fathers were, but yield yourselves to the Eternal and enter his sanctuary, which he has sanctified forever, and serve the Eternal your God, that the fierceness of his wrath may turn away from you. Notice he places stress upon the primacy of the temple in Jerusalem. He says, don't keep worshiping him at Dan and Bethel. Look to the sanctuary that God sanctified forever as the place where he was meant to be worshipped, and come down here and join us in that. For if you turn again to the Eternal, your brethren and your children shall find compassion before him, before them that led them captive, so that they shall come again into this land. For the Eternal your God is gracious and merciful, and will not turn away his face from you if you return to him. He said, surely if you turn with one heart, one mind, to worship God the way he originally intended. So the posts went from city to city through the country of Ephraim and Manasseh, even to Zebulun. And they laughed them to scorn and mocked them. However, many of different peoples of Asher, Manasseh, and Zebulun humbled themselves and came to Jerusalem. Now it's interesting that it's right at this particular period of time, archaeologically speaking, the city of Jerusalem expanded enormously. It was a sudden expansion in the size of the city of Jerusalem. And that's why one of the leading archaeologists who's been involved in the excavations in Jerusalem, his name is Magen Broshi, he ventures the opinion that the reason for the expansion is because many of these people came down and were so excited about worshiping again at the sanctuary, they decided to stay. But you actually had an addition of people from the northern kingdom, of this remnant, that established themselves permanently in Jerusalem. It's interesting that among the tribes that are mentioned, it mentions Asher. And remember, in the New Testament, there was a prophetess by the name of Anna, who sat in the temple daily and was involved fully with prayers and to God, praying for that she might be granted the boon of seeing the Messiah. And if you look in the New Testament, you find that she was of the tribe of Asher, possibly one of these descendants. We know that some of these people must have settled in Judah, because when the Jews returned from their captivity in Babylon and resettled in their homeland, some of them resettled territories that were in the northern kingdom. So they must have been in Judah at this time. And then they were carried away to Babylon along with the Jews. They had no choice. They were swept away with that captivity and came back with it. Also in Judah, the hand of God was to give them one heart to do the commandment of the king and of the princes by the word of the Eternal. And so they kept this very great Passover. And as it says, it enumerates those that kept it, that there was this remnant. Notice in verse 25, all the congregation of Judah, with the priests and the Levites, and all the congregation that came out of Israel, and, interestingly enough, strangers that came out of the land of Israel and that dwelt in Judah rejoiced. Apparently some of those foreigners the Assyrians had planted in the land, who, as chapter 17 of 2 Kings points out to us, began to adopt a mongrelized form of religion, their own old pagan ways mixed with Israel's worship. They responded to the call also, and some of those even came. And these dwelt in Judah.
some of these northerns. Okay. Notice there was a follow-up in chapter 31. When all this was finished, all Israel that were present, all those that had turned in their hearts towards the true worship of God, went out to the cities of Judah and broke the images in pieces and cut down the groves and threw down the high places and the altars out of all Judah and Benjamin and Ephraim also and Manasseh until they had utterly destroyed them all. Then all the children of Israel returned, every man to his possession, to their own cities. And the priests and the Levites were again appointed to their courses. And everything was set in order as it was supposed to be. Well, God was impressed, but he still felt the people needed to be punished for their sins in the days of Ahaz. And so in chapter 32 we read that after these things and the establishment thereof, Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, came and entered into Judah and encamped against the fenced cities and thought to win them for himself. And he did. We have recovered archaeological records of Sennacherib's campaigns, and they record that he conquered every fortified city of Judah. He fulfilled the prophecy of Isaiah chapter 8. And then the Assyrian records record that Sennacherib laid siege to Jerusalem. Sennacherib says in his document, "I trapped King Hezekiah of Judah in his capital city like a bird in a cage." But you know, the record doesn't claim total victory. It does mention that Hezekiah sent him some valuables, gold and silver and precious things, as a way of buying off his anger. But it nowhere says in the records that he subdued the city of Jerusalem, because we know from the Bible that he didn't. And what we'll do, I think, is break off here so that we can begin at this point next time and take a look and see what happened at the city of Jerusalem and how God acted because of Hezekiah's willingness to exercise faith. And he delivered the city of Jerusalem. We'll pick up with that next time.